The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Rowntree. I am COO at ExchangeWire and I am joined by Rachel Smith, ExchangeWire CEO. Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Lindsay.
Lovely to have you.
Thank you very much.
It's been a while since you and I've done
this. Well, yes, definitely. It's been ages since you and I have done this. I was just saying to the guys the other day, I very rarely get invited on the podcast
these days.
Me too.
I feel left out now.
What have we done?
I know. Yeah. Built this amazing product and now everyone else is taking it and running
taking the credit.
Doing a great job, to be fair. But yeah, I feel a bit left out now. I'm getting some FOMO.
Good to be back in the hot seat though.
Absolutely. And our very special guest this week, returning guest this week, is ITV's Paddy Kelly. He is head of digital at ITV Commercial. Hello, Paddy.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back.
Yeah.
In our new office.
Lovely.
Yeah. Even if you didn't bring
the Love Island water bottle for Anne-Marie.
The swag.
Who hasn't stopped talking about it for the past year.
I can only apologise. It will be rectified.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good to know.
Better be.
Yeah,
absolutely. Write that down.
Listeners, he genuinely is writing it down. This is promising, very promising stuff. I'm going to bring us into our first story, which is broadly UK brands are still relying on third-party cookies. So the 26th of April, which was Wednesday just gone, marked the two-year anniversary of Apple's IDFA changes, requiring mobile apps to ask users for permission to collect and share their data with their Ask App Not to Track notification. This has required brands to focus on collecting more first-party data, and stats show that this is a good thing for brands. A report from Twilio shows that 89% of businesses are reporting that first-party data is improving their customer experience. Data from another survey indicates that 71% of UK consumers trust brands that only use first-party data in their personalisation efforts. So why is it then that only 5% of UK brands are using entirely first-party data and 53% are still predominantly using third-party data? According to Twilio's report, the state of customer engagement. The findings also showed that 29% of respondents are using a combination of third-party and first-party data. The report looked at consumer sentiment as well towards cookies and found that 32% often reject them when visiting websites and 50% have actually left a website in the past 12 months rather than accept cookies, I assume because it's been so difficult to try to work out what they can and can't say no to, they think it's easier just to leave, which I've experienced myself. Further to this, only a third of brands are treating the shift to first-party data as a critical priority, and just 38% of UK businesses are prioritising first-party data within their personalisation strategies. So there's a lot of stats there. I've just bombarded you with a lot of data. Hopefully that's registered. I want to understand, and Paddy, I'm going to come to you first, kind of why you think brands are still so focused on third-party cookies. What's the blocker? What's the barrier for them?
Obviously there's a need to future-proof, right? Everyone gets that. But you need something pushing you, which I think is a deadline from Google, to push you to get away from something and something pulling you towards it. And perhaps the thing pulling you isn't as robust or as developed as these advertisers would like it to be. I suppose the other thought process is it's hard to wean off all of the insight and measurement that cookies do give you. So it's going to be a gradual process and simply declining that is ridiculous. But the first time I thought about this was it feels like, because such a small proportion of internet traffic is, okay, cookieable, it feels like worrying about a broken toenail when you've got a broken leg. It's you're optimizing something that's quite a small proportion of it. But then, sort of, perhaps that's naive. So you think Chrome obviously dominates the web browser market. It obviously doesn't apply to search specifically, but then advertisers would understand where they're coming from. Therefore, they would have third-party cookies on their websites. So it applies to that 13 billion plus the 10 billion that's on display. So therefore, understanding where your consumers are coming from and then retargeting, which seems a lot to me for something that consumers do find irritating, but it is effective. So I kind of get the logic behind it.
Rachel, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Paddy that there isn't enough push and pull here. So I do think that, you know, Google's delay of deprecation of third-party cookies hasn't helped the cause. And I also think that, you know, what we've learned about brands and marketers In this industry, perhaps in a general capacity, but certainly when it comes to, you know, online advertising, is that they don't tend to change their tactics unless they absolutely have to. And that is not just, you know, there's all sorts of arguments get put forward around that. You know, some people call it lazy, some people call it poor, you know, business modelling. I actually think it's because they've just got a whole range of things to do, and very often they just want to use whatever is working. And the truth of the matter is that despite the challenges that you mentioned there, Patty, you're right. We're not talking about, you know, an enormous reachable audience. But despite that, I think a lot of marketers are still getting success in using those traditional tactics in those environments. So for them, although they probably are well aware of the fact, I certainly hope they are, that changes are afoot and that they therefore need to change their modelling, they're not, you know, what they're using is still working for them. They have other priorities. And I think a lot of them are also just hoping that their agency partners and that their tech partners are going to work together with them to try to find a workable solution. I think there is also a lot of confidence in the idea that, you know, tech solutions that are indexing towards IDs will work and will continue to work. Of course, there are other concerns around that associated with, you know, privacy and consumer control legislation, and also that doesn't address the issue that a lot of consumers are just getting tired of cookie consent, you know, banners, which is just making them, I suppose, less willing than ever to share their data, not just in that environment where you're being targeted with a cookie banner, but in lots of environments. I think a lot of consumers are now like, I'm just not, you know, if I get the option, if I get the choice, I'm just not going to share my data because I'm tired of being bombarded. So I think it's a collision of a number of things, but the push and pull thing is number one. And I think number two is that marketers are still getting some effectiveness from the existing tactics.
I think that's a great point. I think that one thing that I don't know what brands were surveyed in this research, but of course there are many brands where first party data just isn't really an option for them.
There's that as well. Like it might be an impossibility for a number of brands.
But then they wouldn't have cookies, right? So if you take an FMCG, their website isn't going to be important to them. They're not going to be doing tons of search. They might be doing display. They're not necessarily retargeting because if you're searching for Bird's Eye, that's, you know, there's no reason to retarget someone. So it's typically the businesses that have data that are going to be doing this. So I went on a mobile network website to kind of take a look at this and kind of see what was going on. And I got 14 advertising trackers dropped on that particular website. And we're in talks with this particular brand about doing a first party data match. And we know that their data isn't quite ready yet. So that, and they haven't got the right permissions. So the pull for them to do a first-party data match campaign with us and perhaps others that are integrated with clean rooms is there, but this needs to happen to force them to get the correct permissions, so then they've got that usable data, and then they'll start to see the value of doing this first-party data. I do think this research is conducted by a company called Twilio, who are a first-party data management platform.
So
I'm not suggesting they're scaremongering, but I do, and I'm sure it's a great product, but it's... I think we have to draw people towards things rather than necessarily. So offering them results and showcasing how it has worked for brands that are doing it well, I think is probably the main thing. Because this feels like going in circles, it's going to be different for every advertiser as to why they might be doing it and for whatever reason. But again, I would also add that pressure on marketing spends at this particular time, CFOs are going to be challenging why you're spending where, and cookies do give people a, you know, that sort of performance lens, whoever came up with that term is a genius. But anyway, of understanding how their business is working, how their marketing is working. So they're probably leaning on that a fair bit.
Yeah. And pressure on marketing spend is one thing, but actually maybe pressure from the likes of Apple, from the likes of Google is not what the answer is. Them saying, well, you must, you know, if you don't jump, you'll be pushed. Mm. Actually, maybe exactly what you said, Paddy, you know, working with guys like yourself to kind of show them what they can get if they make the jump, start working more with first party data and show how it can be results driven. Otherwise, all you get is pressure. You're going, I don't know what to do. Where do I start? Who do I speak to? Whereas if you've got trusted partners you can go to. They can say, right, well, actually, we've started doing this. What about that? What about that? Let's try and work it. How will that work for your business? You can kind of go, okay, yes, there's support out there. Otherwise, it's pretty terrifying.
And maybe that's the thing, you know, from even some of the brands that you are having discussions with over the course of your business and encouraging them to do some first-party data matching with you. When you're coming across brands that aren't ready for that, do the challenges seem, you know, pretty big to them? Is it a capacity issue internally? Is it a skills-based issue? Are there reasons that you could see that brands would clearly potentially back away from that bit and go, oh, no, we're not ready. It's just not the right time for us?
A myriad of reasons. Just to add, I'll come to that in a second. Just to add, we've got a CDP, a customer data platform, I think that's called.
It is correct.
They're very expensive. So moving away from cookies is expensive.
Yes.
That's one thing to be mindful of. I do think... can you repeat the question?
I should have gone straight to it.
I should have gone straight to it.
That was a really good point because I'm thinking, what are the natural barriers? It's usually difficulty and cost, and cost is usually inherent in that, right? So you've already out the gate said the cost of CDP is big. So are there
I've answered the question, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, so, have. Yeah.
Are there other difficulties?
In three letters.
Is it a capacity issue? Are they like, how the hell do we get this data? It's a really difficult thing to do internally. I don't know.
Well, one thing, it does vary by brand. One concern is privacy. I would say clean room technology is really good, and therefore that shouldn't be a concern, but I totally get that. The other is obviously financial outlay and the justification for doing it. You know, we're coming for broadcast of VOD, whether that be ITV Channel 4, Sky, whoever else, right, feels like the right thing to be doing because of the ad metrics you get, high viewability. It's an emotive ad, so therefore you can do a lot with your ad. So it's certainly the right place to be advertising. What's difficult to isolate, because we don't have cookies, or identifiers, is how that performs, when it performs, right? So that justification of unboxing that and understanding measurement and the application of first-party data to be more efficient with your media spend, it's a little bit intangible until you do it. So it's, I think, as the brands that are doing it with us and Channel 4 and Sky and everyone else, because it's now a scaled proposition, I would say, it's not individual publisher level, that's something that you'll start to see much more results come from, much more adoption. And I think it's a slow start because I think adoption of InPost on Bunker is growing really, really quickly, but it's nothing like the brand count that we carry as a business, for example. So it's a long way off.
And I imagine as well that what you find with certainly bigger brands where it requires many moving parts to work together, that's always a challenge. You know, you mentioned about the CDP being very expensive. There's also many examples of brands that invest in CDPs, like one team invests in a CDP and then goes to the rest of the teams, here you go, here's a CDP. And they go, what am I supposed to do with this? How does it work? Who's supposed to be running this? And there's no connection between the different departments as to how to actually use these very, very expensive bits of kit. And that will be a challenge that I think many brands are facing at the moment as well.
Well, it's realising the value of it, right?
And absolutely.
How quickly. And as long as we understand that it's not necessarily going to be that quickly and almost that threat of if you don't do it, that's what will happen. Versus if you do it, there's an opportunity. So it's how, you know, I would suggest it's incumbent on us as media owners and I suppose supporters and investors in InfoSum to help to message that to marketeers so that they can convince their CFOs. Mm. That's where I think we've got to do better as a business.
Interesting, absolutely. Mm.
I was only going to add to that I still think we speak with lots of brands on lots of issues pertaining to ad tech and marketing tech where they talk about how hard it is to convince their fellow C-suite execs across the business of core marketing principles because we're still, I think, in a phase in history where the CMO is in some businesses at the top table but in plenty of businesses not at the top table, and so just trying to communicate all of those principles can become really difficult. So, yeah, it's probably a collision of a few things that makes progress a bit slow.
Massively.
Indeed. I'm going to move us on to the second news story of the week. So Newswork, the marketing body for the UK's national news publishers, have introduced a new trust calculator, which helps brands and agencies better understand how they are perceived. Using consumer research, the calculator presents companies with a trust score based on how familiar, famous, competent, and risky they are considered to be compared to 150 other brands. I don't know what these brands are, by the way, just clarifying that. The calculator was designed based on two research projects by Newsworks, one which measures the effectiveness of advertising within news brands, and the other which focuses on how to quantify user trust. The marketing body describes the calculator as a more accurate measurement of trust, which considers the multifaceted nature of this crucial metric. Using this new metric, the study found trust is 1.5 times higher when a brand advertises on a news brand website compared to a non-news brand website. Now, I had a look at the calculator, and basically it's a sliding scale that you're basically, as a brand, supposed to go to market with. So go to kind of a national representative number of people, ask them to rate their, how famous do you think insert brand name here is, how familiar are you with the brand name, how risky would it be to buy something from this brand, et cetera, et cetera. And then you take the averages, and the scores you get are compared and pitted against 150 brands they've already done this metric with, and you're given a trust score off the back of it. So Rachel, I'm going to come to you first. How important do you think that trust is as a metric? Like, you know, there was a comment I read that, from a conference last week where it was, I think, noted that trust shouldn't be considered as something that's a wokey metric. It's actually very, very important, and important more now than it ever has been. So where do you perceive trust on the scale of kind of what brands and advertisers should be thinking about?
I think trust is critically important for brands and advertisers. Have you ruined everything over there, sound guy? Lindsay is doubling up listeners as host and sound guy and has tripped over some cables sitting down, which is a really impressive effort.
I got my foot caught in a variety of cables under the table. Just let me untangle myself and make sure I don't do it again. Apologies. There we go.
And right. He's hoping you can still hear us. Can you still hear us?
I can still hear you. Nothing's been unplugged. As you were.
So trust, I think, is critically important for brands and advertisers, because if you think about just your own consumer spending habits, I would say that 99% of the time we spend money in places and with brands that we trust, that we know something about. Yes, okay, plenty of us buy stuff from brands that we've never bought from before, but that path to purchase, particularly these days, since we spend a lot more time purchasing products in a digital environment, whether that's via our phones or via our laptops or whatever, is even more critically associated with trust. Because I don't know about you guys, but when I'm targeted with advertising on a social media platform, I try to spend as little time as possible on social media platforms because I don't like them. But when I am there and I get targeted with some really interesting advertising, I can wander off into product territory. And just before I go to buy, I'm like, hang on a minute, do I know anything about this brand? How much do I actually trust them? I find myself doing some research and going off that social media platform to verify the brand and to find a little bit out about it, etc. So I'm sure that people are doing that more than ever before, certainly of a particular age demographic, maybe youngsters less so because they've grown up in an environment where they've purchased stuff online all the time. So yes, that's super important. How then does a brand retain trust? They do an enormous amount of things to do that, I'm sure, in the ways that they build their brand out. I completely see the correlation between trust and advertising on news branded properties. That does not surprise me at all, because I think social media platforms are becoming to some extent denigrated by all of the controversies surrounding the content that thrives on that platform, how it gets there, who moderates it, who sees it, who doesn't. And I think that there is a bit of a wave of people moving away from certain social media platforms too. I'm not saying there won't be new ones to replace that, but I think people are becoming a bit more suspicious of purchasing via platforms that they're less familiar with than they were even 3 years ago, even in the height of the pandemic. I think people's sentiment, consumer sentiment, has changed a lot. And then one final thing on news brands. I know you only asked me one question, Lindsay, but here I go.
I did. You either do a compound question or a compound answer. It goes either way.
Compound all round. News brand website, like, people are, never mind purchasing products, just consuming news and information. People are spending more time on news brand sites and properties than ever before for the same reason. So lots of people that would typically have consumed news and information via social media platforms are not getting to that news and information isn't getting to them anymore because of the algorithms that are driving targeted advertising on those platforms. And I think people are just stepping away from those platforms and actually going to the news brand properties themselves direct to consume that information. And so I think that is creating an even more potentially valuable proposition for brands. That's just my perspective.
Very good perspective. And Paddy, from your perspective, I mean, from ITV's perspective, trust must be huge as a brand in and of yourself and one of the most recognised brands in the UK, but also the advertisers that advertise on your platform, that there must be a huge kind of parallel between the trust that they instil by advertising your platform and vice versa and consumer sentiment towards it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a study, and I haven't got the stats, is that if ITV introduce your ad, there is a massive bump in your brand trust.
Doesn't surprise me.
Look, this is absolutely the right thing for NewsWorks to be doing. And there was a time when we all talked about at events how news is a really important part of the UK media ecosystem. I don't think necessarily advertisers respond to that particularly well. I think what they respond to is something that's tangible and meaningful for them as a business. So why should I be spending there? Why should I be paying the premiums rather than this long tail of internet? I think so. Definitely the right thing for them to be doing, particularly as they're more reliant on digital investment. But if you take it from the advertiser perspective, the challenge is efficient reach first, then it's effective reach, and all sorts of incrementality thrown in the mix there. My feeling is that trust is one of those things that feels intangible in terms of I'm buying a really trusted campaign with really trusted publishers. How much is that actually impacting the ROI of my particular campaign? That's quite intangible for them to gather. This gives them a way of kind of understanding it and tracking it. And I think this is something, you're absolutely right, Rachel, that it's really, really important to major brands, and that the downside of appearing in the wrong place or not fostering trust is a massive issue. Whereas, you know, if you take those brands that you mentioned that launch on social media, trust is perhaps a nice to have for them and therefore is less important. So if you take, to try and give a real example here, is Mojave Slippers. I don't know if you can remember them.
Yeah, definitely.
We've got Sir John Hegarty coming to our business to help us be more creative. Which is definitely something I need help with. But anyway, Mojave Slippers used to be worth 100 million quid, valued at. And they did a lot of social media. And I'm sure this isn't the only reason, but it's a reason. And Sir John Hegarty was actually an investor in them and tried to advise them accordingly. If he couldn't convince them of branding, then
who cares?
Would have been a miss. But they did a lot of social media, some outdoor, etc., on tubes and stuff like that. They didn't kick on and build their brand, because then that trust eroded, and therefore when they needed to grow and deliver a much more significant return, start to become profitable, they couldn't do it because they were unwilling to invest in the future of their business and build that trust with consumers to kick on to that next level. Because I would say, Rachel, that you're naturally skeptical, which is the right thing to have. I would say that the natural British consumer doesn't think like that, and they perhaps might just purchase on more of an impulse, perhaps, I don't know. And therefore, having that trust is an important factor in that decision-making. So that's where more established media and media that is has different rules and guidelines around it. For example, you can't say what you like in the creative on TV. It has to be verified. We had one example where an advertiser wanted to say faster rather than just fast. And Clearcast were checking, faster than what? So I don't think consumers care about that, but that's the level of scrutiny you go to, and that's why it's such a trusted platform to go on. And you know, I really do applaud the work that these guys are doing around repositioning why spending on news is an important thing.
Yeah. It's really interesting, because I wonder though, I mean, yeah, you're right. Perhaps I'm not typical of the average British consumer, but I sort of feel like people are getting more skeptical of stuff on the internet rather than less. But maybe, certainly my perspective on that skewed. I mean, we all see things through our own lens, but also maybe it's because I'm thinking about the younger sort of side of consumers, where I think young people are certainly they're very price sensitive because they've not got as much cash as older people do, but I also think they're kind of they shop with a different conscience. They're not necessarily impulse purchasing, and I think then they need to be convinced of the authenticity of a brand, which kind of goes alongside trust to a certain extent. So I just wonder if that's a metric that's going to change, you know, quickly over the next couple of years, because you know our consumer habits and patterns are changing so fast. I don't know.
Yeah, look, I think the media plan has got more variables to it than ever before. If you think of sustainability, ensuring you're reaching diverse audiences, whether that is a cost-effective medium. If you're talking about sustainability, how effective is it? Is it too effective to then? Because we are all advertising products that people don't necessarily need. Maybe some are, but that's something that has to be considered in media plans these days, ensuring that the future investments as the business, let's take when you're selecting an agency, that might be a factor as to why you might select a particular media agency because of their credentials. This is another factor that makes it even harder to understand where you should be spending and why. But I think this goes some way to helping make something that was previously too ethereal to actually measure, and this is bringing some
putting
form
a bit of science
of,
behind it.
Yeah. Which I think is important.
I think that the trust aspect and the Mahabir's example that you gave is an interesting one, because we've had many conversations with direct-to-consumer brands over the years, certainly when we used to run a direct-to-consumer publication, and speaking to them about what was important to them, and brand building was never a focus for them. They never felt the need to build a brand. They wanted to just get in front of people and get their product in front of people. And then a few years down the line, you'll see a lot of these direct-to-consumer brands are now advertising on TV. They're now advertising out of home, and they're actually trying to build a brand name rather than just kind of try and sell, because they realise they need to. And actually, while maybe the younger generation are not quite as loyal as maybe the older generations are in terms of what they want to go to, trust is intrinsic with that, right? So actually the trust aspect does come with the brand building aspect really, really importantly. And that's why these DTCs that always eschewed any kind of brand building exercises are now feeling they have to go, they have to go down that road. I think that this ties in with that really, really well as to the importance of people feeling familiar with you, they trust you, and they don't see you as a risk, see you as risky. And this kind of risk-taking thing is a massive thing. Like, people don't want to take risks. They want to go somewhere they know they can get what they paid for.
And that is true of the content they watch as well, because the biggest shows on, not the biggest, I think the third biggest show on Netflix is Friends. The biggest show on, one of the biggest shows on Disney Plus is Bluey. And some of this, it's this legacy content, and Grey's Anatomy, sorry. It's legacy content that people know what they're getting. There's an element of trust there. They're not taking a risk on this new piece of content that they might not like for 30 minutes. They know exactly what they're getting. So that plays true in very small decisions as well as bigger purchase decisions as well.
That's very interesting. I didn't know that. I'm not surprised by that, but the fact that the most popular shows are ones that have been around for 20 years. But
I know.
Yeah.
Because that means that they're also being watched by a really diverse audience these days, because it's so much more reachable. So, yeah, I think I find that fascinating. Kids being interested in Friends, like, who thought it would stand the test of time like that?
Yeah. I mean, parts of it probably haven't aged very well, and the younger generation will point that out on a frequent basis, but they'll still watch it. So, you know. Anyway, moving on to our third story, which is actually about TV viewing and streaming. So, perfect. Right up your alley, Paddy. So a new study has found that people in the US are increasingly favouring ad-supported streaming options. The 2023 Inflation Nation report by the Y Group looked into how the economy affects how people spend their money. And it turns out that demand for ad-funded offerings has never been higher. Basically, people are trying to save some cash and ads are helping them do it. The report says that 7% more people signed up for ad-supported tiers in 2023 compared to last year, and a whole third of respondents admitted to cancelling a subscription to sign up for one that had ads in its place. It's more popular with the younger generation. 21% of 18 to 34-year-olds either have cancelled or plan on cancelling their ad-free subscription for one with ads. Maxine Gurevich, who's the Senior VP of Cultural Intelligence at Horizon Media, summed it up pretty well, actually. Ads are something people love to complain about, but if they're getting value out of the service they're watching, ads don't necessarily undermine their perception of value. The key to future success will be maximising relevance of the ads they see while minimising feelings of intrusiveness. So, Paddy, I want to come to you on this and understand kind of, you know, this is great for the likes of ITV and ITVX, kind of what that means. Like, you're probably not surprised by these figures that actually people are going towards more ad-funded. What's that mean for the future of ad-supported streaming?
Well, it's in rude health.
Good times all round, right?
It's in a very good place at ITV. I think it's difficult to say that this macro level impact is how that's impacting everyone's individual decisions. BBH Labs did a study around how nothing changes over 20 years, only that advertising is more annoying. It was the only thing that had changed significantly. People's view on finances and everything else. Now, perhaps the world is on fire. So maybe that's those views might change more quickly. I do think you do make, this is one that I think most people are feeling, I would suggest the vast majority, and therefore you're going to make more decisions around what you spend your money on. A day out, a night out, as a family of four, a day out is expensive. So a subscription is a comparative bargain depending on how many hours you use it. So, but if there's ways that you can make those small trimmings and kind of cut back, then that feels like a simple way of doing it. It's something you feel like you've made some changes. Whether that materially impacts your overall outgoings, then that's different. I suppose the thing here is it says 7% growth, right? I'll check I've got that right.
But it does.
Is that new growth of, because Netflix's ambition is obviously to grow.
Yes, or is it just shifting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My sense is shifting because they haven't necessarily marketed it because they're focused on revenue per user rather than necessarily as well as growth. This was the first step to them doing revenue per user. Mm. And the business is now profitable. So that's one angle of doing it. The one thing, now that Barb, for those that don't know, Barb is the TV measurement tool. It's gold standard. It's in over 5,000 homes. It tracks your viewing for those particular homes. And then that's extrapolated out. We now have streaming data within that. And Netflix is down, I haven't got the time period, but it's down from 46% share of streaming to 36% share of streaming, I think in the past year. So that is a significant shift. And I suppose recognition of the fact that Disney Plus, BBC iPlayer, ITVX and others are really making inroads into that space. Look, when I say streaming is in rude health, I think the connected TV market is in good health. I think we want to make sure that from a consumer perspective, that's being reflected. The eyeballs are following that quality content. And ITVX is in a really good place. You know, we hit 1 billion streams on April 9th. It took us until September last year to do that.
Wow.
March was our biggest ever month for consumption, which when you think about it, there wasn't any, I suppose, ITV tentpoles. There wasn't a World Cup. There wasn't a Love Island, I'm a Celebrity, these sort of major franchises that top up. This was, I suppose, ratification that the strategy of ITVX, which is depth of content and that diversification of content, is something that's really having an impact on people's behaviours, and they are choosing ITVX as their way of accessing it. Typically, people are comfortable with the degree of advertising they're seeing, and therefore that's where, and as long as you treat the consumer with a decent level of respect, that's where their eyeballs will go, and then they sort of understand that trade-off, and then obviously that's when advertising support follows.
With the ad-supported streaming, there's a lot of people moaning about the quality of it, that there's lots of gaps, there's lots of repetition, there's lots of issues with not loading properly. Are we seeing improvements in the technology behind that? I mean, are you seeing on your platform kind of the improvement in, I guess, engagement in the ads in the first place? So like what kind of things are you tracking there?
It's very difficult to track engagement with ads because the viewability is 99%, completion rate is a 99%. So you kind of, because it's to a degree a forced view, it's difficult to get learning. So you could perhaps see when people are switching off from that content. So it's hard to know a useful data level to understand what viewer behavior, etc. Now, it isn't. Actually, running a streaming service is very difficult to do without it falling over. Live broadcasting is very difficult to do, as is rumoured with...
As Netflix found out.
Indeed. And the thing with linear TV is it's extremely reliable. It doesn't fall over, whereas this does. So there are glitches, of course there are, and this with every service, and we are working through how to improve things like ad frequency. As viewing behaviour changes, as people binge more episodes, people come back to the service more frequently because there's content for them to do so, then we're addressing how we kind of control frequency. But that's where, you know, our ambition is to double monthly active users from an average of about 10 million to 20 million by 2026. That is ambitious.
Very. That's no mean feat, is it?
Yeah, I'm kind of glad that's not my challenge, but we do have to double revenue. Anyway, it's fine. Mm-hmm. So that service needs to be deliver on Slick. Some of those fundamentals that, you know, you probably see complaints from people that complain more, and that it's, I would think that the vast majority, as demonstrated by the viewing, are happy with the service and it's going well. So how much you pay for that is another thing, and that relationship with the advertising. But yeah, I think that's where Sky have managed to strike that balance really well of a subscription service an expensive one.
A very expensive.
Rob, and a pittance compared to the US, because you might pay $100 for one service, one set of live TV channels, no other part of the service. So I totally understand why people are doing that and this cost-effective angle to that. But, it becomes a bigger deal when you turn on the entire service. So I think Disney Plus did that $7.99 tier where you had to pay to remove advertising almost. That feels like a more scalable proposition and gets people comfortable with advertising. I know Discovery Plus did the same thing. They saw no material change in their subscriber levels. So not to give Netflix any clues or anything.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And Rachel, from your perspective, especially given the US, and we understand kind of, with the US's relationship with streaming and with all the different skinny bundles and the different streaming platforms that exist over there, are you surprised that everyone's flocking to view TV ads?
Not at all. I mean, I think that there are marketplaces, particularly the US, where they're very very ad tolerant, I would say, much higher volume of advertising. They've been exposed to a much higher volume of advertising over their lifetime of television consumption. So I think that they've got a higher tolerance anyway. I also think some of this will be absolutely being driven by price sensitivity. So whether that's here in the UK or whether that's in other global markets, and again, being driven by a younger cohort of consumers who are, I think, as well, which might be one of the reasons behind this notion of desiring more flexibility associated with ad-funded models. I think you might have a pool of younger consumers that are used to, with less sort of loyalty and brand loyalty, are used to being able to consume things as they need and as they want. So they sign up for something for a couple of months so that they can binge a couple of series and then they're on to something else. Or they would stay a bit longer term if they could have a more affordable price point, and maybe that means, higher tolerance of ads or something like that. I can understand why flexibility would be important to that. They've got much keener eye on their monthly outgoings. I also think we talked about this a lot even before some of the major streaming platforms adopted ad-funded modelling like Netflix, that household budgets just can't sustain a certain volume of subscriptions, even if it's not about price sensitivity, if it's just about being sensible. Like, how many of us would continue with subscriptions when we're not actually really accessing the service? I think people are becoming much more tuned into that, right? So there needs to be a sweet spot of some options for a variety of consumers in terms that are willing to pay for ad-funded content. So a couple of different tiers, which means a certain volume of content or a certain volume of advertising, and periods, of time that they can be signed up to the service. And then I think there also needs to be a good read across associated with the content. For years we were hearing that Netflix would never be ad funded because that was the whole purpose of it. It was high quality content without advertising. Well, since when does high quality content mean no ads? Like, that's nonsense. We consume loads of high quality content associated with ads. There's also high quality advertising as well, and really, excellent entertaining advertising. And I think we are at a really interesting, from a creative point of view, inflection point in the industry where hopefully we'll see some of those things start to collide for the better, give consumers options, and also just improve the quality of advertising and improve that, that sort of consumption of content alongside ads, just improve that entire experience.
You could do an Amazon and not give people choice and do an annual subscription. I think it's annual. I don't know if there's an option for monthly, but
I think there is an option
at a more competitive at a more competitive price
right,
point.
Right, okay. Yeah. But so Amazon Prime is a thing that's bundled together with the streaming. I use Prime, less so the streaming. That's personal. But, if you think, how could you protect your streaming service and ensure that you can increase pricing? Because they're going to need to arguably boil the frog, right? The prices are going to have to go up in order to sustain their business models. And unless... I think Disney is in a really great place because they're able to bundle with, say, parks or something else because they've got so many strings to their bow. And Netflix, they're looking at obviously gaming. That might be a way of bundling and adding value to an already, hugely valuable subscription. So I think these businesses need to look at this, and Amazon are obviously doing a very good job of that at the moment, as a way that they could retain people and ensure that they are retaining revenues for those, even if they are seeing advertising or not, as the case may be.
And do we think that the popularity of BVOD and SVOD actually gives us the opportunity to really innovate on a technological perspective and actually flip the idea of what advertising is and looks like in those spaces on its head?
I mean, I would love to see that. I was thinking about it just as you were talking about ITV's tech capabilities there a moment ago, Paddy. Why does the SVOD ad break need to look the same as a linear TV ad break? It doesn't, right? And people they're consuming the content in different ways, as you just described, and at different frequencies. And you could do lots of really interesting creative things with advertising in that context, right? And it would be great to see that.
I mean, thanks to IAB 2.6, you now can. I think the problem was initially that the ability wasn't there because of the formats not existing, but that's now changing. Is there opportunity to actually kind of really change, not just kind of an ad break, but actually kind of advertising more generally on how it looks on a platform, on a BVOD or SVOD platform?
First things first, I'm going to steal a colleague's Reese McGrockin's comment. I want to make sure that we're not conflating custard and mustard. In powder form, they look the same, but they're obviously very, very different. I would say a premium streaming service, a premium broadcaster service, is quite different from a CTV service.
Yes, so true.
And therefore, and the targeting of ad, the challenges that come with buying of each of those is very, very different. I think if you want... There is Channel 4 are doing actually an interesting test around ad clutter, so ad load, and therefore how much does that impact effectiveness or, in fact, viewer behaviour. So it'll be interesting to see what the results of that are. You know, there are a few brands on board to trial that. Be interesting to see what Channel 4's angle with that is, if they're thinking of a subscription tier or you pay more for that particular access to a lower ad load, because otherwise monetizing that content, it needs to be sustainable. The other thing to consider is... advertising needs to be scalable as well. So this is why the 30-second spot works so well, is because, A, it's easy to place in particular places. Consumers are comfortable with it. You can do a lot with it in terms of creativity. You can drive a lot of emotion with that. And of course, advertisers can understand the effectiveness of that and so on. I think if there's other opportunities, like integrating partners into particular shows, those are more difficult to do. I think Netflix is in a nice position, and Disney, as their global propositions, therefore you can integrate more deeply. Emily in Paris, I think some of that might have been fairly obvious product placement.
It was unbelievably obvious, yes.
There is more things to do, and obviously technology unlocks a lot of that, certainly from a targeting and measurement point of view, but how can we do more in terms of creativity? We've got a dynamic creative proposition. Now, that doesn't pertain to ad load, etc., but it does allow advertisers more options of how they address their consumers. So you could do a regional creative, for example, that one of our partners does, has an overall branding creative and then a regional incentive. So they do different creatives underneath their headline branding creative, so they can understand how it's performing in a particular region, scale budgets up, down, move things around, so they can be much more flexible. So there is ways of offering propositions that are scalable, without actually completely rewriting the rule book in terms of how you deliver and drive revenues for these advertising and actually fund this content market that we all love so much.
Sounds exciting.
Very.
Mm. I'm going to move on to part two of the podcast. We've kind of already started broaching on the topics, but it's a chance to find out more about kind of what you guys are working on ITV, understand more about ITVX. We've obviously mentioned it, kind of actually give, for those that aren't aware, a description of what ITVX actually is and how it's going, because it's been an exciting launch for ITV. And kind of, what is it and how's the performance coming along?
So it's going really well. ITVX is ITV Hub was a catch-up service, and ITVX is a streaming service. So it's gone from 4,000 hours of content to nearly 15,000 hours of content. So it's a step change. And we've invested an additional 160 million quid on top of the billion we already spend on content into exclusive content for ITVX. Main changes being there's access to films. We've done content partnerships with Warner Brothers, for example, and anime content as well. But there's also films. So in the region, we've got 500 films, but 150 are live on the platform at any one time. So we had a Fast and Furious kind of block where we have access to that content. The other thing that £160 million is going towards is ITVX exclusives and premieres, where we're putting the content on ITVX first, and then for 6 months, 6 to 9 months, and then it goes on air. So it's kind of flipped the model on its head. What we've seen is with shows like Unforgotten, Without Sin, which was an ITVX exclusive, that does around about £2.5 million per episode, which is pretty significant. You then have something like Unforgotten, which aired on TV first, that actually does over 3 million. So it's kind of the whole mix of content and how that's working is obviously, we're all learning on that. And Without Sin is going to go out on air for linear, I think in May. So we'll understand how that sort of model has changed. But consumers are really responding to the marketing, I think, is really good. We've gone up in terms of consideration. I think on YouGov's survey, we went from, I think, possibly 6th to 4th in terms of ranking of consideration as a streaming service. So that's going to make a material difference to how often we get people to come to the service. And I've touched on some of the stats before. So I think the strategy around bonfires and fireworks. So there's major shows like I'm a Celebrity is that firework. It burns bright, World Cups, etc., where it's, you know, it's on every single night, and therefore streaming does really well. Whereas the World Cup, that's more linear TV. Everyone get together. And actually, interestingly, for England versus France, that got 2 million streams live on ITVX on a Saturday night, whereas obviously the linear does significantly better. It was over 20 million. So, but still 10% of the total, which is up on previous tournaments. So it does show that people are using that service, much more comfortable using it, and want to watch. That's their way of accessing ITV's content. So it's going well, and that's having a knock-on effect for us as a business. We've also put in fast channels. Again, those are relatively small, but I think their time will come as we sort of start to have put more support behind them. So from a streaming perspective, it's going very, very well, and ITVX is being really well received. I think from an advertiser perspective and from a commercial perspective, I think what we as a business, we've sort of almost taken on, adopted some of the ad tech mindset of a roadmap of propositions, right? And we've got this roadmap of innovation, and we're communicating with the market much, much more about what's coming, even if it's in its infancy. So programmatic TV, for example, where you ad replace live TV ads, kind of like a Sky Ad Smart, we've replaced live TV ads. We're doing really, really small tests at the moment, but if you think about the scale of streaming as a business plus ad replacement of live TV, where you can do all of that intricate targeting that, you know, TV is broad and mass, that's some of its power. I think where digital agencies are starting to adopt, and actually we're starting to see a lot more people invest that using our digital proposition only, so 220 advertisers were doing that in Q1. So yeah, it's and 84 new advertisers in Q1 as well, so that are new to the service, never spent with ITVX. So that's a big change that, you know, it feels like we're gaining a bit of pace.
And what, sorry, butting in there, Lindsay, what does that look like internally for ITV? Because it's really interesting hearing you express that, you know, sort of strategically you're thinking yourselves as an ad tech company or an ad tech proposition with a full product roadmap. How has that settled down internally within the business? Has it meant the bringing together of disciplines and teams that weren't necessarily aligned before? What does it look like?
So I suppose the significant changes, we have a product team, which is, that's probably doing them a disservice, but they're ITV Ad Labs. That's where our sort of innovation comes from. And that's probably a new change, which I'll come on to in a sec. We've also got the technology team is now integrated within commercial. So our illustrious managing director, Kelly Williams, now has technology under his remit. So where we were working with another technology partner, we've now brought that in-house for Planet V2, which is kind of the new version of, and it's kind of a reimagining of it. Planet V1 was fine. Planet V2 is much better. and it's much more set up for the onboarding of other partners for Planet V2, which is the thing that, should be calling it 2.0, should I? Anyway, I like to. And that's where I think Planet V lives and dies. So that's where the structural changes come.
Yep.
I think that mindset change, where we've the creation of ITV Ad Labs, we recognise that, you know, buying reach and frequency is one metric that advertisers deal in, and you know that's obviously an important thing, and it's a, I suppose, a proxy for the things that they actually care about, which is their share of viewing, share of voice, their consideration, their brand metrics, and you know, a spot to search, for example, that's obviously a very important measure of success, and then actually sales. So we need to move much, much closer to that end of it, which is what we've done with our matchmaker data match is one where we're working with InfoSum to then match data. People can start to see the effectiveness of that. We've launched very recently our kind of retail data proposition. We're a partnership with Dunnhumby and Boots, where advertisers can target consumers of specific products, run that advertising, and then see the effectiveness on the back end. So we are, as a business, getting much, much closer to that from a And that's where our digital proposition comes in, but also offering advertisers geotests for free that we kind of support. We've created a share of voice tool so you can understand. This is something that Google do really well, where they give you an understanding of what percentage of search you are getting, and therefore if your competitors are, you know, winning more or spending more on their search, that means they're stealing market share from you. So then advertiser A responds in kind. We've created that for television. It does already exist, but we've made it faster and much, much easier to use. And again, free of charge, because we want to kind of democratize all this information and start to help people understand the effectiveness of TV and how important that is, as well as these geotests, spot to search, kind of test uplifts that you can be really, really robust. You don't have to spend £1 million. It can be small regions like Tyne Tees or whatever else. You can focus on where it's relevant for your business, and we can kickstart and see how that works and test and learn and grow. That's the mindset change, I think, that has come as a result of that slight structural change that you asked about.
And that's really interesting, because I was also then just thinking, so then what does that feel like from an advertiser's point of view, or from a, you know, from a client's point of view? Because it's quite a sophisticated offering that you've got there. So how do you help them navigate through that? I think you just articulated that. It's fascinating.
Not without its challenges, but yeah. Mm. So right, that's the next thing for us to do, right? Yep. We have to get in that game.
And everything you met, I mean, you just kind of mentioned this yourself, but everything you talk about and all the different options available, you sort of think like you've got to be a real big money advertiser to take advantage of this. But actually, given the very nature of TV advertising as well, and the fact that it's rarely national, it's often, well, there's obviously big national things, as often it can be so targeted, actually it's a real opportunity for brands that would not think that investing on ITV or buying ads on ITV would be an opportunity for them. It truly can be.
Yeah, I'm slightly conscious it's a massive sales pitch, but anyway.
I love it. Yeah.
We're kind of here to help.
We're assisting you.
Yeah, thanks.
We are.
We're here to help. I think that perception is definitely true of new advertisers that perhaps grow with the likes of Google and Facebook first and are concerned about taking what often gets called a leap of faith. It isn't a leap of faith. I don't think it is. Well, perhaps I'm being blasé, but it's the next natural step. And if you don't take it, you then might fall foul of Mojave's sort of fate.
Nobody wants to be a Mojave slipper. Well, no. They're lovely slippers.
They're very comfortable slippers, aren't they? Yeah. I mean, I don't ever own a pair, but I'm sure they were delightful. Yeah, I'm sure they're wonderful. I want to just quickly kind of ask you a bit more about the targeting and measurement piece as well, and kind of how important that is from an ITVX perspective, kind of how advertisers can really take advantage of the capabilities there versus what they would normally have bought on ITV Hub or indeed on linear TV as well.
So from a targeting perspective, look, we try and group things depending on your objective. So if it's extension of linear, there's targeting options that are relevant to that. I don't think it's relevant to this podcast. Content alignment. So if you want to cherry pick specific content, you can do that. But then if you want to refine your audience, there's things like integrations with Experian, MasterCard. We've got affinity audiences around fashion, for example. So if someone's bought an item of clothing on the Love Island app, that's a piece of data that we use to inform that, for example. But then there's other things like, now, if you're doing it at a mass level, take a major advertiser, it's hard to isolate the impact of ITV unless you're doing econometrics, right? That's kind of because it's such a macro level and it's quite long term. But there are tests and ways you can construct things to understand without hugely impacting your media plan, because often when you want to construct a test, it's difficult because you then have to completely change your media plan. One example was a retailer was skeptical of television overall. We then put one region dark, so no advertising in that particular region, so a county or whatever, and actually had a significant impact on their search, the open rate of their emails, their direct mail, their footfall to store, and actually worked out that in the short term, it had, for every pound spent, a £5 return. For that longer term, which I think is over a three-month period, was £15 return. So where I think it is challenging to kind of get into the weeds and create some of these tests, but what I would say is this team are really helping to kind of construct it so they can do proper integrations with your Google Analytics so that you can actually use some of these more tangible digital touch points to understand how it's working, and therefore is my PPC getting cheaper as a result kind of thing. So that's the bit that we really want to explore more.
There's only so much you can do as well. The advertiser had to play a role here too. I'm thinking of the eBay Love Island collaboration where eBay were advertising during the ad breaks of Love Island, but in Love Island they were wearing eBay clothing and then they were saying, oh, shop this look on eBay, which was a fascinating thing because it was obviously kind of sustainability perspective really interesting, but you often kind of wonder what does success look like for eBay in that example, because you can't actually go and buy an outfit from them because that's not how eBay works. How are they measuring that themselves? What support are you giving them to kind of measure and help them target effectively? Just the whole connection is very interesting.
Yeah, without giving away
trade secrets,
yeah, precious details.
Of course,
I think look, there's that was a really, what's it? Brave's not the right word. A really exciting investment from eBay, and I think
it felt exciting actually watching it. It was interesting for me, kind of understanding TV advertising. It was a really interesting collaboration.
Yeah, and it's a step change for Love Island as a proposition as well, as going towards something much more sustainable. And that's why I think it got a lot of standout in our industry, but actually the business impact is really good as well. I think there is, when you do a partnership with us, you typically get some form of research that comes with that to understand brand impact and everything else. It is incumbent on us to collaborate with that advertiser to understand how that's affecting their business. And they obviously do sell clothing in terms of this. So, and that's a massive part of it. So they are able to track, because their advertising elsewhere stays the same, and therefore they see this. They're able to isolate the impact of this particular partnership and see where, say, searches of clothing on eBay, I think, went up by 8 times, for example.
Wow. Amazing.
Slightly concerned, that number's not right.
Paddy's making a grimace there. Yeah. He's not quite sure about the number, but we'll keep it in. But it sounds good.
It's eight times.
He's confirming it's eight. Brilliant. We are out of time, but thank you so much. That's been a really interesting conversation. Rachel, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Paddy, thank you for coming in and joining us today.
Thanks again. Yeah, brilliant.
Great conversation. This has been the Mad Tech Podcast. Thanks for listening.